There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. Media freedom, our right to communicate. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, how early German radio experimenters presaged the vast social media of today. My guest is Daniel Gilfillan. He is an associate professor of German studies in the School of International Letters and Cultures at Arizona State University, and he's got a great new book out on German experimental radio. Oh, you do want to stay tuned. Good evening, Daniel.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Very well. How are you doing there?
Pretty good.
In beautiful, beautiful Arizona.
Thanks for inviting me on the program.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I really enjoyed this book, which is out now at the University of Minnesota Press. And, you know, I think one of the things when we think about early radio is what's lost to most people is a notion that it really ever was a new medium, that it ever really was a new way of communicating, and that what we receive today as the way radio works, as a broadcast medium, as a medium of sending a message from one to many, was not necessarily cooked in from the beginning, that it wasn't preordained, that it wasn't a gift from God to man as a broadcast medium, but is the result really of social processes and legislative and governmental processes. And so what's fascinating about your book here is how you examine the early days of radio in Germany. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how radio was an experimental medium, back in the 20s and even earlier.
Yeah, I think you bring up some excellent points, especially in the German example, in which radio initially was a two-way communication device, and that it wasn't until after the First World War that it began to be legislated and regulated to become a reception-only device. Prior to its deregulation as an entertainment medium, where it became available as a way to broadcast cultural material in October of 1923. And I think what's interesting about that is that it brings in a number of related ideas about government sovereignty over the airwaves, a fear on the part of the fledgling Weimar Republic democracy that other people would be able to broadcast of their own free will rather than having a sense of control over the airwaves in that way. I think one of the interesting things about the experimental aspects of early radio is that prior to World War II, there was an avid group of radio amateurs, people who would self-build, self-construct their own radio sets, and initially would broadcast to each other using Morse code as a way to entertain themselves and to try to see how far away they could get a response from that type of initial engagement with the technology. The war saw the medium being used primarily for tactical purposes on the battlefields, And it was in 1917 that a man named Hans Bredow broadcast the first music utilized his two-way communications devices to broadcast gramophone albums to people in the trenches. And he would later become the commissioner for radio in the first years of its deregulation.
And so what we have there, so this is in the World War II period, and in the post-World War II period are these... post-World War I period. So we have radio amateurs, and it's something which, you know, a lot of people are probably familiar with that we have today, you know, ham radio amateurs who do this.
Exactly.
But there was something a bit more, for lack of a better way of putting it, sort of anarchic about this. I mean, not you know, that they were expressly anti-government, but that... It was more truly experimental, right? I mean, so you have this gentleman who started broadcasting gramophone records, and this was largely a first. I mean, this wasn't, you know, this is something he ostensibly came up with on his own.
Exactly, and I think the balance between experimentation versus an anarchic use of the medium comes. In the very volatile post-war, the first couple of years following World War I, so 1918, 1919, saw the German government changing hands several times. There were revolutions in the streets, decommissioned officers coming back from the front, no longer employed, didn't have anything to do, and they became involved with what now has been known as the November Revolution. So if you think about it, you have about 190,000 to 200,000 demobilized Signal Corps soldiers coming back with their equipment, which at that point it can be used for transmission and reception. And so you have this possibility of you know, 200,000 people broadcasting their ideas, and this became kind of a touchstone for the fledgling government to try to then need to regulate and legislate. The idea of anything that was brand new with these radio amateurs was certainly anything that was done for the very first time could be labeled experimental, even though today we would consider it, you know, fairly innocuous, fairly flat. So something like the broadcast of gramophone records would be something that we wouldn't even take a shine to as being experimental. In the same way that the very first cultural broadcast in October of 23 was the recitation of a poem, which today would probably bore most listeners to death.
Well, and you use that as a touchstone in your book, the recitation of this poem as a first broadcast, because it has significance beyond the simple fact of having been the first poem recited on German broadcasting.
Right. I see it as an avenue into understanding some of the practices that would start to gel around early radio, as far as the remediation of content from other venues such as poetry, so other texts. But also concerts, opera, those types of things. But it also brings into play an idea of the ways in which the radio could compete with other contemporaneous media like cinema, which has certainly taken off in Germany during these same years that they're. I would call them brothers. Cinema certainly came of age a number of years earlier, but where cinema was grabbing onto German cultural narratives from the medieval period or the Romantic period, radio. This one particular radio poem also draws that kind of a national sense of identity from. The choice of the poem from a well-known German Romantic poet, Heinrich Heine, to allow, I think, for some competition so that they could, you know, that they could themselves as competing with the other media within the Weimar media landscape.
You know, I find this idea that you had these Signal Corps men coming home mm-hmm. from the war, posing, you know, I guess a threat because they,
right.
you know, because they're suddenly put into peacetime, but with the skill and I guess ostensibly the equipment.
Exactly.
I mean, do you have any sense or record of how much what would I guess we would consider unlicensed broadcasting and transmission continued on in that immediate post-war period?
Figures that I've read maintain that there were this group of radio amateurs numbered around 100,000. If you add these. The Signal Corps officers, the decommissioned officers, you'd have about almost close to 300,000 people with radio sets.
Hmm.
But whether or not they all used them is another. It's hard to have that kind of data. I think.
Is there any record of enforcement of attempts to shut folks down?
Not that I was able to locate.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But it's. I think what initially happens is you throughout the. From the squashing of the November Revolution in 1919 to the deregulation of radio reception in 1923, which allowed the medium to become a broadcast entertainment medium, you have a whole series of legislative actions. One calling for the retooling of the device such that it would become a reception-only device to... also outlining what should be done to someone who was caught what they would call eavesdropping on waves that weren't shouldn't have been accessible to them.
Mm-hmm.
There was this fear that these radio operators would go onto medium wave or ultra high wave and find military conversations and then rebroadcast them on their own. I wasn't or haven't been able to find that type of data, that type of textual information about what actually happened to people or not.
So we don't know whether this was in response to actual events happening or a certain sense of paranoia,
right.
You know, an active police state already being generated there.
Well, certainly... certainly the takeover, a number of these decommissioned officers took over the Central News Bureau in Berlin, and it's from that Central News Bureau that any type of telegraphic communication would have been sent out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this definitely a palpable point where they could have easily... claim the success of the revolution and had people mobilizing for a civil war, I suppose. I think that fear was definitely something that was justified at the time.
And you are listening to Media Geek, Media Freedom and Your Right to Communicate. And I'm speaking with Daniel Gilfillan, author of new book, Pieces of Sound, German Experimental Radio, out now on the University of Minnesota Press. And you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. And the radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, any questions, send them to me, MediaGeek@gmail.com. And follow the Twitter feed, Twitter.com/MediaGeek. Now, Daniel, these first broadcast stations now, the first broadcasters in Germany, mm-hmm. this is state-run, correct?
Yes. There were about... By 1928, 1929, there were 9 regional stations. In the initial years, there were, I believe, 5 or 6 that began right away in 1923. They would all be sort of shuttled through a main transmission station at a place called Königswusterhausen, which is outside of Berlin. And so they were all regional broadcasters, but with owned by the postal ministry at the time, and they were subscription based. So So listeners were required to register their radios. This is another way to keep track of illegal radio devices.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have they would drive around, or they would walk around trying to detect signals. And if someone has had an illegal signal, they would bring them up on charges or fine them in some way. Yeah.
And one element that you bring up in the turn from to being a broadcast medium is the fact that the actual technical development of these receivers was a bit stunted because of a technology, the feedback technology, which would allow the receivers to become much more sensitive, but also involves them becoming, radiators themselves.
Exactly, yes. And this was a retooling of the device that was sort of the last hurdle for it becoming available as a broadcast medium. And partly that was also a win situation, because they were able to then market it as a new type of entertainment medium.
Mm-hmm.
In the retooling of the radio from transmission and reception device, but also in the fact that they wanted to sort of clip its wings in a way, from being able to achieve these kinds of more strengthened signals, they then sort of quelled a lot of the governmental fear of a possible type of lurking on airwaves that they weren't meant to be lurking on.
Was there any debate at the time about making this system government-run, being a state system? I mean, Americans tend to take for granted a privatized broadcast system, although that's an exception compared to most of the world, and especially Europe at the time. Was it a subject of debate, or was it sort of always, is it seem almost assumed once the medium was captured as broadcast?
Well, the regulations and legislative standards that began to surround the medium really harken back to an 1892 telegraphy law, which stated quite adamantly that the airways were the property of the state, and that they would always be under state control.
Mm-hmm.
And it was modified in the late teens, early 20s to include radio broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not until actually the early 1980s that you get a more vibrant commercial broadcasting setup in Germany itself.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, you have state-run television, a couple of different channels, and cable television and radio stations didn't start to emerge privately until the late 70s, early 80s.
Right, like much of Europe and much of the world, which often didn't have private broadcasting, commercial or otherwise, and well into the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 20s there, it seemed as though the development of radio and its role and its purpose was a subject of fairly active debate and discussion, at least it's the way it seems from your book, including, such known, thinkers at the time like Bertolt Brecht.
Yes. Well, Brecht really comes on the scene somewhat late in 1926 in his engagement with the radio, and he publishes or pens a series of essays, one of which he basically wishes that the radio would be a two-way type of device, perhaps not knowing that it once was.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars claim that he overlooked or didn't even didn't even know about the new telecommunications laws in 1922 and 23, which clipped its wings. So yes, it becomes, in a way, radio. The minute the radio's wings are clipped, as far as being both a transmission and a reception device, is the minute the radio starts wishing nostalgically for recapturing that mode, and it's the only way that you have theorists who look back or want to try to regain that, and then you have practitioners who are attempting to bring a level of interactivity back to the radio through coming up with very specific radio formats that sort of move away from the initial mandate to really just duplicate other content from other entertainment venues and become much more radio-centered, radio-focused, as a way to hopefully activate or engage listeners in some way.
So by comparison, I mean, what was that original mandate? You've mentioned, you know, to sort of duplicate other sources, whether it be music or poetry. But I mean, what was the effect? I mean, what was the real purpose of that duplication?
Well, in 1923, October of 23, economically, the country's in a state of intense hyperinflation. A lot of economic hardship, unemployment, a lot of worries about where the next meal would be coming from. You have hundreds of thousands of veterans on the streets, homeless. And Hans Breda, the first radio commissioner, maintains that that the radio should be there to provide recreation, entertainment, and variety, in order to distract the German public from these economic hardships. So it was really meant to be a medium of distraction and to get them to stop thinking about the worries of their day. But when you think about the number of people who had radios already in October 1923, it's really a drop in the bucket. It's a very small number. It's probably under 5,000. People would have been able to even afford to own radios, which is why initially radio started out in coming into play in public listening venues. So people would stop off somewhere and listen to the radio in a collective kind of audience format until they became more and more affordable. So then you have producers, initial artistic directors, or the pioneers, someone like this gentleman, Hans Flesch, who was the first artistic director at the Radio Frankfurt, who's on the one hand trying to balance this need for entertainment, but on the other hand trying to push the medium further and come up with ways in which he could maybe create it in the vein of an artistic medium rather than just a communications medium or a duplication medium.
I mean, it's from your descriptions of some of these broadcasts and radio pieces, if you will. I mean, they sound provocative today.
Well, I think this one artistic director, Hans Flesch, produced the very first radio play in almost 1 year to the day of the start of the radio in October of 1924, in which he does a type of Orson Welles move where he disrupts a program that audiences would have been tuning into the evening concert. And what he does is he develops a radio play, which is sort of a meta narrative about the radio studio. So the play itself takes place in the studio. The characters in the radio play are the people working at the studio. And all of a sudden you have a disruption of the evening concert by these two sort of otherworldly characters. One is the a magician, and the other would be the storyteller who would normally appear on the radio in the mornings for the children's hour, but all of a sudden is at the radio station at 8 p.m. at night, which for a listening audience would have been sort of unfathomable to all of a sudden hear the storyteller start telling a story.
Right. I mean, what's interesting is that, I mean, there's this already questioning the received notions of how this medium should work so early on. And when you said, you know, did an Orson Welles move, you're referring, of course, to Orson Welles' famous broadcast of War of the Worlds,
which
fooled people into thinking that Martians were landing and invading the Earth. But, I mean, this would predate Welles.
Yeah, it definitely predates it. And it's a way to sort of unsettle the listener's idea of what the radio could deliver to them. Because it goes against a sense that radio is sort of pre-programmed, or that the schedule is the thing to follow. And yet it was all of maybe 25 to 30 minutes long, and it would disrupt the Viennese waltz, and then the play would run about 20 minutes, and then it would then just come back to the Viennese waltz where it was left off, almost as if it never occurred at all. And it was a way to get people to try to think of, you know, to get them out of this idea that they're listening to the radio to be distracted in a way, I think.
Well, Daniel, I think we're about out of time here. Thank you so much for joining me. Once again, Daniel Gilfillan is Associate Professor of German Studies in the School of International Lectures and Cultures at the Arizona State University. We've been talking about German experimental radio and his new book, Pieces of Sound, available from the University of Minnesota Press. Once again, thank you so much for joining me and sharing this great hour.
Thank you, Paul, for having me. It's been a great experience.
Great. And perhaps, you know, you'd like to come back.
That would be great. Yeah, definitely.
as
my next book comes out.
or your next paper, or the next great radio or media kernel you happen upon that you can share with us.
Yeah, that would be excellent. Yeah, I'm doing some things right now on the role of memory and sound. So,
great.
I don't know if that's something that would interest you or not, but we'll see.
Yeah, please. Well, do. Please keep me up to date.
Definitely. Great. Thank
you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. And that brings us to a close of another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment, including Jerry Del Caliano of InsideMusicMedia.com, helping us understand the really sad decline of commercial radio. Go to MediaGeek.net, radio shows at radio.MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, MediaGeek@gmail.com, or tweet me, twitter.com/MediaGeek. Thanks for tuning in.